wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I am your host today, Joe Clement. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole is a radio magazine that brings you news, reviews, interviews, perspectives from an underground radical socialist feminist point of view. We bring you several interviews today. We're going to start off with Bill Resnick talking with sociology professor Alex Vitale, who you just heard about on our promotion. They're going to be talking about his book, The End of Policing. Alex is also coming to Portland in a week and a half. He'll be speaking at Portland State University on October 11th as part of the Imagining a World Beyond Policing panel discussion, which will be from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Building. And then, as you heard in the promo, he'll be at the Dismantle Change and Build Center on October 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. talking about creating a world beyond policing. You can find more information about these KBOO-sponsored events at kboo.fm under the Community Events calendar. Later in the show, I'll be bringing you a five-minute digest of union news, a segment that I'd like to do more often called A Union Five. Desiree Helligers is going to be speaking by phone with Lexi Peterson-Burge of the Vancouver-based Noble Foundation about racism at Clark College and in Southwest Washington broadly, and about the continued fallout from the Clark College Foundation's lawsuit to try and keep OPB and OPB reporter Molly Solomon from gaining access to records bearing on the racial climate at Clark College and the Clark College Foundation. As a point of disclosure, Desiree Helligers teaches for WSU. To wrap up our show, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, our Left in the Law duo, will discuss the death penalty in Oregon, and specifically Oregon Senate Bill 1013, which passed earlier this year, limiting the definition of aggravated murder, the only crime that is punishable by death in Oregon. You can find past episodes of The Old Mole in their entirety and as individual segments that you can share at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can like us on Facebook and Twitter to get more updates and be a part of the broader Old Mole community. And you can email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with your comments, suggestions, questions, or if you'd like to be a part of the show. We'd really like you to be a part of the show. Thank you always to KBOO listeners for contributing and for contributing to our fall membership drive, which wrapped up this weekend. You can always donate or become a member of KBOO by going to kboo.fm/give. And lastly, before we turn to Bill and Alex Vitale, I'd like to extend a congratulations to Old Mole Lori Mercier for being elected to the KBOO board earlier this month, along with Teresa Mitchell, Ruba Leach, and Kat Meow Garcia. Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Alex Vitale on The End of Policing.
Alex Vitale, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Alex Vitale teaches at the Brooklyn College in New York City's university system. He coordinates the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project. He wrote a magnificent book, The End of Policing, published in 2017. He's an engaged academic, lots of TV and radio interviews, does visits around the country, consulting with citizen police reform groups, and also talking with those police forces and some public officials who realize that modern policing is very harmful, even to the individual cops themselves. That is, policing has to change. He's coming to Portland in 12 days from today, speaking on October 11th and October 12th, discussing Imagine a World Without Policing. KBOO is sponsoring both talks, and you'll hear a lot more about it in the next close to 2 weeks. His book, The End of Policing, it became an instant classic because it synthesizes a really vast amount of material. It's completely accessible language description. It examines, it's exciting actually, and it's almost dramatic as it sort of makes its case. It examines the history of policing all the way to today. Their ranks greatly expanded today, but still doing their old job, containing the poor, cleansing the streets, disrupting labor and political challenge, sometimes killing people and getting away with it almost always. He critiques modern policing and all its its functions, most of them with little to do with crime. Its chapters look one at a time at police operations and hassling the homeless and prosecuting a war on drugs, only, of course, in poor and black enclaves. Also arresting, sometimes killing people in mental health crises, and the police send them on their way, their journey to jail. And each chapter examines alternatives. He distinguishes those police reform alternatives that in reality operate to strengthen the current police system, distinguishes them from real, useful, often community-based helping programs. The End of Policing concludes, pointing out that even the useful reforms, even altogether, they can't succeed if the U.S. remains so unequal, with so many people driven to desperation and despair, and others, of course, to illegal ways of making a living. With that in mind, he addresses how we can work, however, in the police reform movements, the ones that are really useful to advance the struggles for a more just and democratic society. Alex Vitale, it's really a wonderful book. But first, what's wrong with modern policing?
Well, I think we have a pretty good sense of what the major problems are. Over the last, 5 years with the rise of Black Lives Matter, we have a very good understanding about the excesses of police violence and the lack of accountability. I think what needs more attention is the broader problem of over-policing. So we focus so much on a handful of very high-profile injustices, but we sometimes lose track of the 10-plus million low-level arrests police make every year that really do almost nothing to make us safer, but that really just drive more poor people into the criminal justice system. So despite all the activism and upheaval of the last 5 years, I haven't seen a whole lot in the way of really meaningful changes to American policing. We've seen a few training programs here and a lot of rhetoric from police leaders, and yet police continue to be the tool that's used to manage the problems in poor communities, especially non-white ones.
Yeah, it's also vastly expensive, right, in so many ways. The prisons, the police, the whole rest of the system. That money could be used for something that would be much more socially productive.
Well, that's one of the main points of the book, is that the decision to turn social problems over to the police to manage is a political decision about budget priorities, but also about an ideology that says the problems that these communities experience are the result of individual and group moral failure that will only respond to punitive interventions. And the alternative to that, that they don't want to address, is the fact that these problems are generally the result of market failures, housing markets, job markets, and also the failure of government to provide any kind of social safety net. So as long as we continue to invest ourselves in or embrace this idea that police and jails and prisons are the solutions to our problems, we're undermining the arguments that say what we actually need is investments in communities and reforms to labor markets, et cetera.
Let's talk about the reforms. You do a lot of discussing of police reforms, some of which are really good. Some of which, though, in fact, in reality, strengthen the police and do very little good.
Yeah, so I think it's crucial that we have a deeper understanding about what the nature of policing is before we start deciding on what kinds of interventions are going to reduce the burden of policing on communities. And I think too often people are caught up in a kind of liberal legal formalism that imagines that if the police just enforce the law more professionally and in a less biased way with more community oversight, that this would fix the problem. So they invest in things like anti-bias training, community policing, civilian oversight boards, body cameras, but there's actually almost no empirical evidence to show that any of those interventions have any meaningful impact on the problems that police produce in communities. And that's because the institution of policing is typically the wrong tool to use to solve these community problems. And that when we use police to deal with drug overdoses, homelessness, mental health crises, failing schools, what we're doing is we're saying we want to turn those problems over to the forces of violence and coercion, which have always been rooted in a kind of racism. And the alternative has got to be to look to those reforms that don't try to just restore legitimacy and public trust to policing, but that actually move us away from using policing to manage problems. So, for example, in every city in the country, we have policing on demand to deal with drug problems, but in almost no place in this country do we have high-quality drug treatment on demand. And so we've got to shift the conversation away from giving the police more training, more resources, more professionalization to why are we using police to solve these problems.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7. Portland, Oregon, talking to Alex Vitale, who wrote the wonderful, accessible, exciting, actually profound book, The End of Policing. We've so far discussed how today's policing creates great harm, particularly for the poor, at vast expense. And he discussed alternatives to policing and dealing with mental health crises and drug abuse. Some of the reform alternatives that turn out to do not much. But Alex, you talk about also some reforms that you think are valuable, like, let's say, drug courts, which really, to some extent, if they're done right, operate like social service agencies that first evaluate the problem and then provide help to people to, in fact, escape the thing that they really do want to escape in almost all cases, the drug addiction. And you do support those programs, is my sense.
Well, there is some criticism of those programs in the book, that by placing things like mental health services and drug treatment services in the correctional system of courts, with backed up by threats of incarceration, this is actually often counterproductive. So we don't want that people end up with access to services only because they've been arrested by police. So instead of emphasizing the provision of services through courts or initiated by police contacts, why can't we just have high quality drug treatment on demand? Because there are a lot of people who would want to access that who don't have an easy way to do so. And also, we need to have robust harm reduction strategies in place to help save lives, stabilize people so that maybe they're in a better position to look for these kinds of drug treatment services that might make a more substantial improvement in their lives.
Right. Let me use another example. Drug courts was not a very good one, I agree. I read an article by you, not by you, by somebody else who quotes you in the Gotham Gazette some years ago, I think, that announced the opening or the establishment of a career center for people just released from jail so they can get jobs and get integrated into the community, which is a nice thing. But in your interview, you point out, well, it is a nice thing, but if in fact we don't create jobs for all, what the career centers become is just a helping device for a few people who happen to walk in the door. So people who get connections in this, who have connections in this society, get better jobs, even if they've made a lot of mistakes in their lives. And connections count. But for the great majority who don't have connections and who don't get into these very few sort of career centers, they don't get jobs. And as long as we have a society whose policies are to maintain unemployment and who have now abolished most public employment programs, even in periods of deep recession, that kind of program that the mayors talk about and the police even like, it doesn't make any difference at all, except it just promotes the idea that they're really concerned and are doing something about the welfare of ordinary people.
Well, they're doing a few things, right? One is that they're promoting that false sense that they're doing something, but also they're promoting the ideology of personal responsibility so that they frame this question of unemployment as one of personal failure so that it's not that labor markets are organized badly. It's not that there's discrimination. It's that you didn't do what you were supposed to do to get a job. And by creating these kinds of training programs or job pipelines as part of reentry programs, if you don't actually increase the number of jobs, you're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak. So what we've got to have is actual economic development programming that's about creating new jobs, not just rearranging who gets the jobs that already exist.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Alex Vitale. We're about ready to conclude. One final issue. In the book, you do accept the decent intentions of people, of most people in some in those programs like citizen review boards and creating jobs and helping reentry and all the rest of the stuff that people do. To those people, you say, look, these things are okay, but we really have to work to make this a more fair and just society where people can look forward to good lives and a society that doesn't destitute 20% of the people and drive them to desperation and into work that's defined as illegal, and another 40%, in fact, who experience enormous precarity and sometimes fall into desperation as a result. Unless we change that, we're not going to get very far. But what is your suggestion to those people who are honestly sort of nice liberals who want to do something and who may really agree with that analysis? How do you suggest that they work in their programs to advance that larger agenda?
To me, the most exciting organizing that's going on across the country right now are places where people are working at the neighborhood level to identify non-police, non-criminal justice solutions to the very real problems that their communities experience, whether it's drug overdoses or youth violence or people experiencing mental health crises or domestic violence. And they're coming together to try to figure out what would make their community stronger and safer, and then demanding that government provide the kind of services that will do that, and pointing out the ways in which policing is not part of the solution and how we should be shifting resources from policing and jails and youth facilities to really creating neighborhood safety at the direction of local residents. So I encourage groups to look in their own communities at what the kinds of problems are that are generating police responses and articulating what you would really like to see. Why can't we have adequate community-based mental health services so that I don't have to call the police? Why can't we have safe injection facilities? Why can't we have community-based anti-violence initiatives in our community? These are the things that will make us safer without criminalizing young people in the community.
Alex Vitale, I'm really looking forward to your coming to Portland October 11th and October 12th. You're one of those at Portland State University. Imagining a World Without Policing is your topic. I know you'll be meeting with many of the police reform groups in the city. Thanks so much for talking to us.
I look forward to seeing you in a few days.
Right. So long.
Bye.
In the big rock candy mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the big rock candy mountains. In the big rock candy mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the big rock candy mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the big rock candy mountains.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Big Rock Candy Mountain, famous wobbly song. And before that, you heard Bill Resnick talking with Alex Vitale about his book, The End of Policing. Alex will be here on October 11th as part of the Imagining a World Beyond Policing discussion that'll happen at Portland State University. on October 11th from 6 to 9 at the Smith Student Union Building. And then the next day, October 12th, you'll be speaking at the Dismantle Change and Build Center on 14 Northeast Killingsworth about creating a world beyond policing. Now I'd like to try something new. This is your Union 5 minutes of union news and views. UFCW 555, United Food and Commercial Workers, announced that they had reached a tentative agreement with Fred Meyers and that the boycott that they called on the 22nd was to be considered over. Details about the tentative agreement have yet to be released because workers have to review them and ratify them. Wages were a chief concern as Fred Meyers could barely pay minimum wage to its lowest paid workers. But also, as I discussed last week with UFCW's Kelly McAllister, there is a wage gap between what men on average earn and what women on average earn. I guess in the coming days and weeks, we'll discover what the workers, with the backing of a boycott and the promise of a strike, were able to achieve. Up until last week, over 80,000 Kaiser workers across the country and over 8,000 Kaiser workers in Oregon and Washington were poised to go on strike on October 14th. A coalition of unions representing workers who were largely not doctors, nurses, or mental health care workers reached a tentative agreement that the workers still have to ratify by the end of October. Kaiser, like Kroger, is a multi-billion dollar organization, with billions of dollars in profits in recent years, and a CEO that boasts a salary over $15 million. For the last couple years, workers have been struggling for decent raises, a ban on subcontracting, an end to shrinking labor budgets driven by automation and technological unemployment, and lower healthcare costs for consumers, whose money should go to higher wages and better staffing, but not Kaiser's profits. This weekend, as UFCW and Kroger came to their tentative agreement, Oregon University workers represented by SCIU 503 came to a tentative agreement with university administration. 4,500 classified staff, which includes janitors, food service workers, secretaries, and other non-teaching staff, were poised to strike today. And because they had the backing of students, the teaching staff, and political representatives, they were able to get higher raises, keep their meal costs the same, avoid cuts to their health care, pension, and time off benefits, and take a community stand against the corporate priorities of the university's budget. The United Auto Workers strike against General Motors enters its third week today. The main issues are health care costs, GM wants to transfer more of the cost onto workers, building more vehicles in the United States, staving off a decades-long trend of sending production overseas. As usual, wages are a sticking point, and what management proposes to give workers is not what they want or need. But the underdog issue of this strike has got to be the way that the workers are taking on the use of tiered wage structures and temporary workers. GM has sought to reduce labor costs, and the union has sought to protect the benefits and wages of its existing workers by allowing more temporary workers and by paying newer workers less than veteran workers. This has led to a situation where people are working side by side, doing the exact same work, making dramatically different amounts of money. Temporary workers make between $15 and $19 an hour, while so-called legacy workers, regular union workers who were hired before 2007, make between $28 and $33 an hour for the same work. Meanwhile, union workers who were hired since 2007 start at $17 an hour and can make up to $28 an hour, but only after working for 8 years. Tiered wage scales, temporary workers, these have long been divide-and-conquer tactics in a strategy of stratification, and GM is far from the only employer to use them to exploit the working class. The wage gap, for example, that UFCW found at Fred Meyer between men and women is a consequence of the underlying tiered wage structure there. The excessive use of temporary workers also allows employers to break workgroup solidarity, to pay some workers who are doing the exact same work less than their union counterparts, and they have far less job security even when they're legally entitled to things like sick leave. That's why over 2 years ago, on-call and temp workers for Multnomah County voted to join AFSCME Local 88. The ostensibly progressive employer has fought the workers nearly every step of the way. For years, they wouldn't even begin to recognize the workers as eligible for being part of the bargaining unit because they said that they don't do the same work, even though many workers, just as in GM's case, will work years in a job, picking up shifts and temporary jobs. At the beginning of this year, we saw the county begin to backpedal its ridiculous arguments that the workers don't, quote-unquote, share a community of interests with regular workers. But every step of the way, the employer has sought to exclude workers from the union by refusing to recognize this or that department. And to this day, workers are still organizing and pressuring the county to recognize everyone who wanted to be a part of the union. As AFSCME Local 88 heads into bargaining this next year, it'd be good to remember the 40-year anniversary of the momentous 1980 AFSCME Local 88 strike, when county workers who control the bridges showed up for work, raised the bridges, locked the doors, the Teamsters jackknifed semis across the other bridges, and Portland was paralyzed. The strike won. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement with your Union 5.
You've got to join that one big union. You've got to join it by yourself. Everybody here will join in with you. You've got to join the one big union by yourself. If that road gets rough and rocky, if the hills get steep and high, we will sing as we go marching, and we'll win one big union by and by.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Woody. Up next, we're going to hear from Desiree Helligers. She's speaking by phone with Lexi Peterson-Burge of the Vancouver-based Noble Foundation about racism at Clark College and why that organization decided to pull a conference out of it amidst the racial climate there.
Today is Lexi Peterson-Burg, and she is the program coordinator for the Noble Foundation, hereafter to be referred to as TNF. Lexi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been coordinating a conference that was scheduled to happen at Clark College on November 2nd, and you all have kind of pulled the plug on that conference. Can you talk a little bit about that decision?
I have been coordinating through TNF, Southwest Washington Social Justice Conference. This is supposed to be the first conference that was organized by community for community in a grassroots fashion through grant funding. And we were scheduled to have it at Clark College November 2nd, as you mentioned. Basically just a community forum, very similar in traditional conference structure, but with workshops and lunch and networking and maybe a panel discussion or a keynote speaker. But mainly it was to bring communities of color and marginalized community members in Southwest Washington together in one space to not only network, but to build affinity with one another and start, you know, really talking about how to address, how community would like to address racism and systemic oppression in our areas, specifically in Vancouver, Longview, Kelso. So we ended up on August 30th having to announce that we were going to withdraw from having our conference held at Clark College due to the release of a week or so prior of an announcement regarding a lawsuit that was happening from Clark College Foundation, which is the nonprofit that runs Clark College's external funding, against Molly Solomon, who is a reporter for OPB, in response to a series of articles that had been written by Molly on behalf of OPB in regards to social equity and
really the struggles around diversity and racism at Clark College.
Correct. Exactly. It was not an easy decision to make, but being as though we stand with community, by community, for community, we didn't feel that it was appropriate to work with an institution that was comfortable pursuing any sort of legal action against a woman of color.
Molly Solomon being Native Hawaiian.
Correct. Specifically around those reportings being about issues that were very relevant to the vulnerable communities.
So essentially, as I understand it, Molly Solomon was filing a public records request in connection with the series of stories that she'd been doing about, you know, racism, institutional racism at Clark College. She filed a public records request with the Clark College Foundation to get some email correspondence, and they turned around and sued both OPB and Molly Solomon.
Correct.
So basically, the Clark College Foundation is filed an injunction against OPB to stop them from getting access to those records.
Correct. So it was mentioned from the foundation spokesperson, Rhonda Morin, that, and I quote, the organization had an ethical obligation, basically wanting to ensure that donors remained private, which was, you know, the supposed reasoning behind filing this injunction.
It's generated some interesting visibility for this whole, fight to keep their records private. And I know that one of the arguments that OPB is making is essentially that the Clark College Foundation draws off of the, you know, the server at Clark College, and that they are pretty tightly connected to Clark College, and therefore they don't really meet the threshold for a private foundation to be able to keep those records secret.
Correct.
So you decided basically to pull the plug on the conference, and you're looking now for a new location which to hold.
We're in a process right now of kind of wanting to step back and reevaluate. Part of TNF's structure and how we function is that we definitely speak to community first. It is grassroots based, meaning community upwards. So really what it's looking like is reevaluating with community and some of our coalition, other nonprofit partners in the area. So it definitely is in limbo. There's no rescheduled date at this time, nor rescheduled location at this time. It's something that we're going to have to build out and make sure that community is comfortable with where and how it's being held.
And again, TNF is the Noble Foundation, and you've been very intimately connected to Southwest Washington Communities United for Change, which has also been involved in this broader coalition of communities of color. Coalition to try to address systemic racism in Vancouver and Southwest Washington more broadly. So, Lexi, you've kind of had this longstanding connection to some of these issues at Clark College.
I started at Clark College as a Running Start student when I was 16, fall of 2010, I believe. Within my first couple of days on that campus, I had a white nationalist neo-Nazi walk up to me on campus and hand me a flyer. And this flyer had all of these statistics, as I air quote, on them that were pretty horrific and pretty graphic and wildly inaccurate. Nevertheless, you know, I felt pretty targeted out and singled out. And at that point in time at Clark College, we did not have a diversity center. There was not a social equity plan. There was no social equity statement or action plan. A lot of the roles in administrative and executive levels now that are devoted towards diversity, social equity, and inclusion at Clark College were not developed at that point in time. So there was really nowhere for this to be addressed or for me to go as a very, very young student on a college campus. There were a couple of student clubs that actually, Queer Penguins and Allies at the time, which is now the Queer Straight Alliance of Clark College, was a big part of the organization that kind of built and mobilized the college to start implementing these things that they do have now. But at the time, it got very hostile on campus. There was a point in time where we were having students of color, specifically women of color, being shoved into their cars, having backpacks ripped off of their back by these white nationalist students who were very open, swastika tattooed, you know, walking around this campus. And the college's response to the flyers initially was that they were freedom of speech and they were, you know, allowed to be posted. And it was a very confusing time for me, especially as a young student there, because we had no structure as to how this was to be addressed. And there were people that, you know, we did not feel safe. And we had to walk in pairs to our cars if we were taking night classes or if we were taking classes during daylight saving times, which this was in the fall, so of course that was happening. We ended up having a forum where we invited the white nationalists to come speak openly at Clark. And that was kind of the beginning of my involvement with diversity, inclusion, social equity, and addressing systemic oppressions and racism within Clark College specifically as a student. And that relationship with Clark I have had on and off throughout the years up until, I would say, the beginning of 2019 when I kind of stepped back.
Yeah, so we're talking about off and on since 2010. So,
correct. Yeah. Throughout those years, I've seen a lot of positive change from Clark. I definitely don't want to discredit the amount of work that a lot of the students and faculty have done to get, you know, what Clark does have now in place there. That being said, though, they definitely do have a long way to go. And historically, as I've seen it, as someone who is very closely ingrained in this work at Clark and has been heavily involved, it feels somewhat like they take a few steps forward to take a leap or a bound backwards. And this is no different. This injunction being filed is no different of an example.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's directed, not simply at OPB, but at Molly Solomon herself.
Mm-hmm. And that specifically is what, I personally can say for me what was my initial huge discomfort. And I feel comfortable speaking for the Noble Foundation as well, that our biggest issue, aside from it being a broader example of systemic racism and inequity, that specifically this is targeted towards a woman of color. And Clark College's history with women of color, especially more recently, has been one that not only Molly Solomon has shed light on, but, a few of us students as well as other faculty, women of color, have shed light on as well. I would hope that it would be of no surprise to the community that Clark College's relationship with women of color has been struggling for, I personally can speak, for as long as I have been attending and been involved with Clark College, and more rampantly this past year.
And specifically this past year was the year that we saw the departure of 7 women of color on the faculty.
Correct.
And staff, who left in the course of a single year.
And very rapidly. I mean, as a student, I can say that I had left Clark College for a few years and came back to find that the women that I had built relationships with, that had facilitated my growth as a student, my growth in social justice, have, helped and supported me through navigating a very weird and difficult time in my life, especially as a queer woman of color who was living in Southwest Washington, to find them all gone.
Yeah, and those departures included Dolly England, who at one point was a commissioner in the Washington Commission of African American.
Yes, along with a few other women who have been very integral parts of Clark College's building of all of these initiatives, who were overlooked and, quite frankly, wrongly not given recognition for a lot of the work that they had been doing to make Clark College a more inclusive space. I mean, I can definitely speak from my personal experience in saying that people who have been internally in Clark, faculty and staff that have been working on these initiatives at Clark College, have not been being pushed up into higher levels and higher positions of being able to have some sort of institutional power in these types of initiatives. And I think that these were very, very qualified women who were doing the work and pushing the initiatives.
And then getting penalized for pushing the initiatives, essentially.
Correct. And also, and not just penalized, but not recognized as well as not given the opportunity to grow and expand in their, careers as well, to be able to push that work forward on a more executive level.
I just want to note, too, that, I mean, this is happening within the context of far broader issues related to, racism and police violence, the shooting, the lethal shootings of 3 people of color, just, I think, since about late last year. So we've seen kind of an escalation of lethal police violence against people of color, including 16-year-old Clayton Joseph, who is a Micronesian student who just arrived in Vancouver very recently. He was a high school student, I think, at Evergreen.
Yeah.
So this is kind of part of this broader climate of racism that people of color are really struggling with in Southwest Washington. I think it's important to note that sometimes we hear this sort of glib stuff in Portland, where Patriot Prayer is over here. It's like, send them back to Vancouver, as if there isn't a struggling community of, people of color over there who are, fighting and organizing and contending with this kind of violence and racism.
Correct. And that is something that I don't think is being, as broadly recognized, is that, like, the idea of systemic oppression and specifically racism within Southwest Washington communities is integral.
I mean, I think we also have to note that a lot of people are being gentrified out of Portland into Vancouver. So our communities are, very, very porous, right? But mostly it's people of color who are being gentrified out of Portland, many of whom are moving to Vancouver and then encountering this kind of climate on the other side of the bridge. And so there is a responsibility for, people in Portland to also be kind of mobilizing as allies and thinking more critically about these issues.
Correct.
And there's a parallel kind of gentrification now going on in Vancouver as well. And a lot of people are being pushed up into Kelso Longview. And there's, that is a really embattled region with respect to racism. So we're just about running out of time. But I'd love if you can tell us how folks can get in touch with the Noble Foundation, how they can plug into the organizing that's going on in Southwest Washington Communities United for Change, how people can support the organizing that you're engaged in.
Yes, yes. So we are very active on Facebook and social media. That's probably the best way to contact us. You can find us on Facebook, just the Noble Foundation. There is contact information directly. You know, send us a message. We are constantly posting on what we're doing, community events. If there is a fair we're attending or anything of that nature, where community is obviously always welcome and we want community to be engaged, please go check it out there. And someone will answer your questions. We'll be more than happy to provide you with information. As well as the Noble Foundation, you can also reach out to Southwest Washington Communities United for Change, which is also very active on Facebook and Instagram. Please reach out to their organizers as well. The goal here is to just get as many people in this area and as you mentioned as well, you know, from the Portland and metro area to get involved in pushing these initiatives and this work forward. As I mentioned prior, we are very grassroots based, and there will never be a point in time where the Noble Foundation speaks for community. I am not an ambassador for all of the marginalized community in Southwest Washington. We need community voice to create community change. So it's very important that if you're interested or anyone that listening is interested to reach out and find a way to get involved, and we definitely could use the support.
And is it fair to say that Southwest Washington educational institutions in general need to really be working on diversity and equity? This isn't just a completely isolated incident, right? These are priorities that need to be taken up across the board.
Entirely.
And we will check back with you definitely to find out more once you've rescheduled the conference. You know, we definitely want to plug that. So we hope to talk to you again soon. And my guest today has been Lexi Peterson-Burt with the Noble Foundation and Southwest Washington Communities United for Change. Thank you so much for talking with me, Lexi.
Thanks for having me.
Just a heads up to our listeners that when we post this story, we will include links to some of Molly Solomon's excellent and extensive reporting for OPB about the racial climate at Clark College. This has been Desiree Elligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You're listening to birdsong right now. I decided to play this in homage to the 3 billion birds who have been put to death directly or indirectly by human influences in North America. A science report came out recently saying. Up next, we're going to be hearing about other beings being put to death or not being put to death with the Oregon death penalty. I just also want to say that Desiree Helligers asked to have us clarify that she teaches for WSU Vancouver. But next, we're going to turn to our Left in the Law duo, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hawken, talking about Senate Bill 1013. Jan?
Well, Mike, as an appellate lawyer working on death penalty appeals, you have two Oregon cases, people on death row. And as of January of this year, there are 30 inmates on death row. And so the new law passed this summer in August, signed by Governor Kate Brown, has important implications for those lives and others who are convicted under the death penalty. So let's talk about, you know, what that law means and its limits. But first, just give us an update on the death penalty laws in Oregon. There's been a moratorium since Governor Kitzhaber signed one or announced one in 2011 that's held since then. But give us a summary of where we are with the death penalty in Oregon before we talk about this new law.
Well, the law in Oregon, it was based on the law in Texas. It passed in the 80s, and then it was modified in the 90s. But it provides that people who commit aggravated murder of 12 different kinds are eligible for death. A death penalty trial has two stages. One of them, the eligibility stage, is supposed to be very narrow. You pick from all the tens of thousands of murders the worst of the worst. And then, but once you've got that small number in theory, then the process of selecting someone for death is as wide as the ocean. Anybody can put on any evidence that might move a juror to vote for a sentence of less than death. And the prosecutors, in turn, can, quote, smear defendants. They can be like kids in a candy store, according to one DA, telling judges how broad the opportunities are for the prosecution to smear and make someone appear death-worthy. So those in Oregon, like in Texas, the main criterion for selecting somebody for death is whether or not he or she poses a future danger. Now, that's always been controversial.
Yes, psychologists, forensic psychologists who are in business to make such predictions are roundly criticized by those who argue their prediction of dangerousness is very difficult. The best prediction is past behavior, but if you don't have, most people don't kill people often enough to establish a pattern other than people in the military, of course.
Well, that's precisely why a big challenge was made to the law in Texas. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, practically speaking, well, we have to make these choices. We do it every day. Is somebody going to commit a crime? Should we give them bail and let them get out? Are we going to give them probation? He said, the right way to do it is not to exclude information showing somebody poses a future danger, but to allow the defendant to cross-examine them and present his or her own evidence showing how full of hooey most of these predictions are, and how, in truth, according to the American Psychiatric Association, flipping a coin would work just as well. So the law has allowed this, and it has been, you know, under steady attack here in Oregon, as has the Oregon death penalty itself. Because for one, there are so many aggravated murders that the difference between an aggravated murder and a regular murder has essentially disappeared. People have argued.
Can you explain, other than reading the definition from a legal standpoint, what can you give us some of the nuances of that distinction, an aggravated murder versus other kinds of murders?
Well, until the law was changed, any murder committed in the course of a felony was an aggravated murder. And that's way more than half of all murders.
And the aggravated part involves intentionality?
No. That's precisely a point, that you can, if somebody dies in the course of a felony being committed, you are automatically the committer of an aggravated murder, whether you had any intention for anyone to die. So the
aggravation is the other in the course of committing another crime.
Right. That is the aggravation. Whether or not it should be or not, that has been, in fact, considered that way. And there 12 categories are so broad and inclusive that it's almost impossible to find a murder that cannot be charged as an aggravated murder. So therefore, you've got complete discretion in the hands of the prosecutor to pick who shall be sentenced to charged with a death penalty.
Because most murders are committed in the context of some other distressing motivated situation.
The broad categories, like the murders of a sexual partner who's leaving you, murders committed or deaths committed in the course of robbing a 7-Eleven store, these kind of things are all considered to be, under Oregon's definition, aggravated, and therefore you can be charged with the death penalty. Then once you're charged with the death penalty, the process of selecting who's going to actually be executed is a process of picking out the whole question of future dangerousness is critical.
That just opens it up. So the model was to have a narrow funnel in the entry, but then it's kind of a free game for legal maneuvering and manipulation of juries once you're in that door of meeting that criteria.
Exactly.
So how did the new law change those criteria of aggravated murder?
Well, it immediately made all aggravated murders in the past non-aggravated in the sense that they were all dropped down to where the maximum sentence would be first-degree murder. They were all made regular murder convictions, and they were replaced with four new crimes: terrorism, killing of a person by a prisoner who's already killed another person, the killing of a child, The most dramatic change, in some senses, was the fact that the whole question of future dangerousness now no longer matters. That's not a basis for finding somebody eligible for death or selecting them for death.
There are a lot of forensic psychologists who've been consulting on this question are going to be out of business.
That's right. But they will be able to continue, but they'll have to shift their vocabulary.
So how you're saying this is an important change. It's not, you know, many reforms are have this effect of seeming to refine and address a problem while putting its legitimacy on new footing. So how would you evaluate this reform in the law in terms of its whether it continues to legitimize the death penalty by narrowing it, making it seem more rational, or moving us away entirely from capital punishment?
I think it has a profound effect, more profound than the drafters of the legislation knew, because what it does is define crimes that were death-worthy crimes as not being death-worthy crimes. And therefore, if any of the people who are now on death row are to be executed, they would be executed in the future for having committed a crime that's not a death penalty crime. And there was work done in Connecticut where a similar law passed that was supposedly prospective only, that showed that no one in this country, no one anywhere else in the world has been executed for having committed a crime that is not a death-worthy crime at the time they were executed.
But that's part of the controversy over this new law.
Exactly.
And the debate that actually led to avoiding a legislative session to discuss it because it was so controversial, the question of whether this would be retroactive, its implications for those who are on death row now. So why is that controversial here? You're saying without question it would be retroactive. It recalibrates the whole situation for those cases on death row.
Well, it's definitely, when you say without question, I mean there are a million questions. The prosecutorial community rose up in a high dudgeon once they became aware of an opinion by the state attorney general that someone whose case was ongoing, they hadn't already been convicted, but they were charged with, and they had a case involving one of the prior aggravated murder cases, the AG was saying, well, we can't really proceed on this because this is not any longer a death penalty, death-worthy law, or it doesn't make you eligible for death.
And you would say, yes, that's the
case.
Well,
the prosecutors were very upset, and they mustered a supporter in the Oregonian and other people to complain about this and say there should be another legislative session to fix this problem. But the way I read the law, the problem cannot be fixed because it's not truly a problem. If you are going to execute somebody for a crime that's no longer on the books, you're going to be doing something absolutely unprecedented, and that would violate the Eighth Amendment. It would be cruel and unusual. It would be unprecedented, and therefore the notion of evolving standards of decency and rarity, singling somebody out to be the first person in the history of this country to ever be executed for a crime that is no longer a death penalty crime, would be a stretch. So there are two clumps of people. One, those who have already been thoroughly processed by the system, and the others whose cases are in process now. I think, in truth, that both these people will have a great claim that the new law prevents them from being executed because of not only the Eighth Amendment problems, but how arbitrary it would be. If you were to commit a crime on September 28th and be eligible for death, why should you not be eligible for death on September 29th?
So part of the discourse around this that's important is another manifestation of the arbitrariness as well as a systematic racism and
exactly
irrationalities of the worst penalty possible under the law. Yeah.
Well, my guess would be that as time works out, there will not be any executions of any of the people convicted under the old law, regardless of whether or not Governor Brown changes her mind about the moratorium.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about capital punishment and the death penalty in Oregon and the new law signed by the governor in August that restricts the death penalty and the importance of that as a meaningful reform.
Well, that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. I want to extend a special thanks to our guests, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, for their important conversation about the changing death penalty in Oregon. To Desiree Hellegers and her guest, Lexi Peterson-Burge, for talking about racism at Clark College and in Southwest Washington more broadly. And as another disclaimer, Desiree Hellegers works for WSU Vancouver. And to Bill Resnick and his guest, Alex Vitale, talking about his book, The End of Policing. Alex is coming to Portland on the 11th to speak at Portland State as part of the Imagining a World Beyond Policing panel discussion, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Building, and then on October 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Dismantle Change Build Center for another panel discussion on creating a world beyond policing. You can listen to The Old Mole online at kboo.fm/oldmole. Just go there in a day or two and you'll find this show with lots of links to promised and not promised content. Like us on Facebook and Twitter and email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with your comments, suggestions, and questions or to become part of the show. Thank you, KBOO listeners, for donating during this fall membership drive. You can always become a member by going to kboo.fm/give.